Welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 531 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. In today's podcast, we're going to be going over a topic that I like to call high-yield contraception. So this is the high-yield contraceptive podcast. This is a very high-yield topic that is tested on the OB-GYN shelf exams and on step 2, on step 1, and on step 3. So just make sure you know this stuff well. Okay, question number 1. What if they give you a question about a patient? The person comes to the office seeking contraception and they really don't have any real contraindications. And then they ask which of the following represents the first line option for this patient. What should you regard as the first line kind of contraceptive, especially if the person does not have contraindications? I would hope you're saying, oh, Divine, it's going to be a LARC. What does LARC stand for? A LARC is a long-acting reversible contraceptive, And there are two things that fall under this category because some people think it's only IUDs that fall in here. No. IUDs are an example of a LARC, but the subdermal progestin implant, the stuff you put under your arm that lasts 3 years, is also considered to be a LARC. In general, those are the most effective kinds of contraceptives. They're extremely effective. I guess the only contraceptive that is 100% effective is abstinence. Abstinence is 100, so you just don't have sex. It's 100% effective. But these LARCs, if a person doesn't have any contraindications, they are first line on your exams. That's very important to keep in mind. They are long acting, so you don't have to do anything every day, and they are easily reversible. So again, in general, think of those as first line. And again, I guess using that question, let's introduce the different kinds of contraceptives. There are many different kinds of contraceptive methods. And I think it's helpful to go through them systematically so that you know which is which. You know, I don't know, for whatever reason, sometimes for people, this can be a very nebulous topic. This can be a very confusing topic. So I'm really going to try hard to break it down for you. Now, the first thing I'm going to say right off the bat is this. Please, this podcast is not for medical decision making. This podcast is for educational purposes only. Okay, so what are the general, just basic kinds of contraception? First one we have is the physiologic methods. Physiologic methods. Obviously, you can begin to see a problem with these. Human error can come into play. So what are the classic kinds of physiologic methods you may see on your exams? Number one is the withdrawal methods. Withdrawal method. So you're like, ooh, it's about to happen, and you pull out. That can certainly cause problems. Sometimes on your exams, you may see that referred to as coitus interruptus. You literally interrupt the coitus. Again, it works, but it's not very effective. High risk of pregnancy with that. It's not very effective. Another classic one is the let me check my body temperature measurement to see when, let me track my body temperature, you know, around ovulation, body temperature rises. So around that period, maybe I shouldn't be having sex. Again, that's a physiologic method. It's effective-ish, but again, risk of pregnancy is pretty high with that. There's also the lactational amenorrhea where, first 6 months after you deliver a child, you know, you can have sex willy-nilly, no problems, you won't get pregnant. Again, it's not perfectly effective. The only kind of physiological method, again, like I said, that is 100% effective is abstinence. And abstinence also obviously reduces your risk of STIs. So in this series of physiological methods, the only one that reduces your STI risk is abstinence. And it's also 100% effective. If you don't have sex, you will not get pregnant. All right. Now, what is the second general category of contraceptives? The second general category are the barrier methods. The barrier methods. So here we have things like condoms, spermicides, sponges. And believe it or not, there are male and female condoms. Although the female condom is slightly less effective than the male condom. And then we have these cervical caps. We have these diaphragms. We have these spermicides. Again, the barrier methods, the big thing, especially with condoms, condoms reduce STI risk. I'm going to say that again. Condoms reduce STI risk. Whenever you see me emphasizing certain things like these, they're very, very high yield to know for your exams. But condoms absolutely reduce STI risk. But again, these things are not as effective as the oral contraceptives or as the LARCs. Okay. Now, next big category are the hormonal methods. So again, remember, on the physiological, it's the abstinence that reduces STI risk. On the barrier is condoms that reduce STI risk. Now let's go to the hormonal methods. These do not, basically, every other thing I'm discussing here, for the most part, does not reduce your risk of STIs. Okay? All right. So the hormonal methods basically fall into a bunch of categories. Category number one are the combined OCPs. Combined. So you see the word combined, it tells you that, oh, there are two things that come into play here. There's the estrogen and there's the progestin. Right? So there's the estrogen and there's the progestin. They're the combined OCPs. They contain both estrogen and progesterone. And these things are pretty effective if you remember to take them. So like the OCP, really, really effective if you use it right. Because many times you'll see for these contraceptives, there are these terms used of perfect use and typical use. Perfect use is if you do everything perfectly. Well, we know people don't always do that. And then typical use is where what most people do. Obviously, with typical use, you're going to get somewhat less effectiveness than perfect use because you're not doing things to the letter. Simple. Makes sense. So again, these are combined methods, like the hormonal methods, right? The OCP falls under that category. There's the NuvaRing, that thing you put in your vagina, that it works. I think you leave it in there for like, I don't know, like 3 weeks. And then there's the transdermal. You basically put a new patch, I think usually on your buttocks or whatever, or your arm, every week. And then you stop the fourth week so you can have the withdrawal bleed. That's an example of the combined whatevers. And then we have the progestin only hormones. There's the Depo-Provera. There's the one you literally, Depo-Provera is the one that you inject every 3 months. The Mirena is also a hormonal kind. Remember, I don't, at least as far as I know, there's no estrogen IUDs on the USMLEs. But it's the Mirena IUD, super effective. Obviously, that's an example of a LARC, but it contains hormones, contains progesterone. And then there's the Nexplanon. That's the progestin implant. That's the stuff you put in your arm that lasts for 3 years. So those, I will say, are the hormonal methods. Now, in terms of non-hormonal methods, you should think of the copper IUD. The copper IUD, obviously, again, the barrier methods largely don't, the barrier methods are non-hormonal. The physiologic methods are also non-hormonal. The copper IUD is also non-hormonal. Okay, the copper IUD is non-hormonal. And then obviously, don't also forget that another class of contraception are just the surgical methods. So, you know, like a tubal ligation, that's a surgical method, it involves surgery. Vasectomy, so tubal ligation, obviously in women, vasectomies in men, those are examples of, those are surgical methods of contraception. Now, one thing I think I want to comment on is this whole concept of post-coital contraception. So, condom exploded, something weird happened, you're like, oh no, I'm worried about getting pregnant. There are many different ways you can go about this. You can use a leave-on orgestrel. You can use uliprystal. You can place IUDs. In fact, sometimes on exams, you may see this referred to as post-coital IUDs. You can place IUDs after the person has, you know, you just place it. Let me explain something here. In general, the one that is the, for this emergency post-coital contraception, the one that is the most effective is in general when you place IUDs, especially for the longest time period. So literally you have a window of like 7 days for the most part when an IUD is placed after, you know, the condom exploded or whatever. That is extremely effective, especially for 7 days. The other methods in general are effective only for like the first 24 hours. So you get those things done within the first 24 hours. Honestly, by the time you get to day two, day three, the effectiveness just drops off precipitously. So just something you want to keep in mind. Like for example, Plan B, leave-on orgestrel, by 3 days after, by like 72 hours after, the effectiveness has dropped by like a third. So it's just one of those things you kind of want to keep at the back of your mind for exam. So if it's been more than 24 hours, honestly, the smartest thing is just insert an IUD. Those are like almost like 100% effective for the first, if you insert them within the first 7 days after the proverbial condom exploded, if you may. So now let's start going through these things one by one. And again, if this podcast ends up being too long, I'll just split it into two. It's not a topic I want to rush through because it's a very high yield topic. So it's something I want to make sure you truly understand. So let's walk through these one by one. So let's talk about the combined OCPs, basically the pills that people take. So again, what are some considerations you should keep at the back of your mind for exams? Well, first thing with these ones is, essentially, the way they work is it's a daily pill. It's a pill you take every single day. And then usually you'll have some placebo pills for about 4 to 7 days so you can have a withdrawal bleed. Because basically the way these pills work is, you know, they give you for, you know, you take estrogen for a few days, you take progesterone for a few days. Basically, they're trying to simulate the menstrual cycle. Remember, your menstrual cycle has a bunch of phases. There's the follicular phase that involves estrogen, and then there's the LH surge that leads to ovulation, and then you have the luteal phase. And after the luteal phase, when the corpus luteum dies, because it lives for 14 days, when the corpus luteum dies, you're no longer pumping out progesterone from it. And then you're, because there are no hormones, you're going to have that withdrawal bleed. That's the menses that pops out. So for these hormonal methods, especially for the combined pill, many times you'll have estrogen for a while, progesterone for a while, and then there's placebo pills you take, you know, like a pill-free break, basically. So you can have that withdrawal bleed. So just something you want to keep at the back of your mind, for example. So how exactly do these things work? It's one of those weird things that you may see on step two or step one, also step three. How do these things work? Well, the estrogen in it, what does it do? Well, estrogen can go to the anterior pituitary and suppress FSH. If you suppress FSH production, you'll suppress the HPG axis. And also by giving estrogen, you suppress the development of your ovarian follicles. Progestin does a bunch of stuff. The key critical one you want to make sure you know for your exams is that it thickens the cervical mucus. If your cervical mucus is thick, it's going to be really hard for sperm to get through. And it also basically slows down, like progestin slows down motility in your tubes, in your fallopian tubes, your oviducts. It's not a common term you may see people use so much anymore, oviduct. But basically, it kind of makes things not move so well in the fallopian tubes. And it also shuts down the LH surge. It basically prevents it. And one other thing I will say to definitely know here is that our friends at the MBMEs, they like to use many fancy names for these things. So please make sure that you know the different estrogen names and make sure you know the different progestin names. Please make sure you know the different estrogen names and the different progestin names. They may not use estrogen, progestin, OCP on your exams. No. Usually on the exam, when they're talking about estrogen, they're going to talk about it as ethanol estradiol. If they're talking about progestin, they can use many names. This is the one where sometimes they can really go ham on it. But let me tell you something that will be very helpful to you. If you ever see the word NOR, N-O-R, NOR, in the name of something, or gestrol in the name of something, that's probably some kind of progestin contraceptive. So they use things, names like norethindrone on the exams, norgestrel, levonorgestrel, drospirenone. These are all progestin. That's the one, I guess, that doesn't. But you see, it kind of has no, at least, in it. You see those, think about progestin. And again, these things are very, very effective. Okay, they're very, very effective. So what are some side effects with these things? You know, women that take these things, breast tenderness, they feel bloated, sometimes they feel nauseous. And these things certainly have problems. In fact, this almost kind of plays into some contraindications. Like, for example, these things can raise a person's blood pressure. In fact, let's make a question out of this. What is the biggest risk factor for hypertension in a reproductive age female? The biggest risk factor for hypertension in a reproductive age female is use of combined OCPs, these hormonal OCPs. These things raise a person's blood pressure. Okay, they raise a person's blood pressure. So if a person has a history of uncontrolled hypertension, they certainly should not be on this stuff. These things, unfortunately, also raise your risk of venous thromboembolic disease. So say, for example, you have a history of venous thromboembolic disease like MI, strokes, DVTs, PEs, you should not be on these drugs. And also, These drugs, because they contain hormones, if you have a history of a hormone-responsive malignancy, like breast cancer, you should not be on these drugs because some breast cancers are estrogen progesterone receptor positive. You shouldn't be on these drugs under those circumstances. Just something you want to keep at the back of your mind. And one thing you should also keep in mind is, again, every now and then they make up some kind of weird scenarios with this. Or I guess let me make some weird integrations here that you should keep in mind. If a woman has acne, a reproductive age female has acne, one thing that may not be a bad idea on your exam is to actually put her on OCPs. OCPs actually decrease acne risk. So consider this as an answer choice when a person has acne and they have like heavy menstrual bleeding and whatnot. OCPs are not a bad idea for those people. And in some of these questions, you may not see like the classic acne treatment. Think of OCPs as an answer. And also, OCPs, yes, I said if you have a history of breast cancer, you should not take them. But what do they do with your other cancer risks, especially your other reproductive cancers like ovarian or endometrial cancer? They actually lower that risk. They actually lower that risk. Because if you're taking OCPs, it reduces your number of ovulations. If you reduce the overall number of a person's cycles, that's going to decrease the number of those destructive and reparative processes that they have in the ovaries. That's going to lower their risk of ovarian cancer. And also, don't forget that these OCPs, you can use them to treat endometriosis. You can use them to treat endometriosis. Okay. Now, next kind of hormonal method I think I'll discuss. Let's discuss the ring. Sometimes people call it the Nova ring. It's pretty much a ring you stick in your vagina for 3 weeks and then you discard it. You give yourself like 7 days so you can have that hormone-free period and then you have your menses. Now, again, these things are pretty effective. But again, they can cause like vaginal irritation and things like that. They can cause like vaginal irritation. Now, what if they give you a question about a person that has this vaginal ring? And over the last like 12 hours or 24 hours, the person has been having high fevers. They've been having like desquamation of the skin. And they give you some labs. You know, you notice that, wow, this person's white count is like 20-something thousand, some crazy high amount. Their temperature is like 102, 103, 104 Fahrenheit. They're just not doing well. They're very hypotensive. Think of what? Toxic shock syndrome. Okay? Again, these are ways they can just make these beautiful integrations on your exams. Think of toxic shock syndrome with this stuff. That's something you can see with the rings. And then again, another classic hormonal method, this one is probably less tested, is going to be the patch, the transdermal patch. Basically, you put a patch every week, you know, for 3 weeks, and then you have that 7-day free period. I truly want you to understand contraception by listening to this podcast. Again, that's why I'm not kind of going, running through all of this. So these things, again, they work pretty well. They work pretty well. So just something you want to keep at the back of your mind. It's just another kind of a contraceptive. Now, one thing you want to keep at the back of your mind when a person is being started on contraceptive is that you need to recommend that at least for a few days, they should use a different method or just wait. Wait for a few days. Wait for a few days before they start having sex. That's probably a smart thing to keep in mind. You know, at least for the first week. At least for the first week, that's generally a smart thing to do. That's a smart thing to do. So again, let me just comment a bit on some of these contraindications and whatnot. Again, I try to integrate them as I was discussing, but let me just kind of comment on them one by in a little more detail, because these things have benefits and risks, right? So what are the big contraindications? What are the big contraindications? Again, if you're postpartum, you should not be on any kind of combined contraceptive. Basically, the examples I mentioned. Because again, they can decrease your ability to breastfeed. They can decrease how much breast milk you make. They can even decrease the quality of the breast milk you make. So something you want to keep at the back of your mind. If a person is immobilized, say for example, again, I'm trying to basically give you all these scenarios so that you're ready for this stuff on your exams. If a person is heavily immobilized, let's say for example they're bedbound because they have like a neuromuscular problem where they can't move, that person, by being bedbound, by being immobilized, it's almost like taking a perpetual plane ride. Obviously, that stasis, unfortunately, is going to raise their hypercoagulability risk. These things raise your risk of venous thromboembolic disease. So if you're in that situation, you should not be on those. If, for example, a person has abnormal vaginal bleeding, we don't know what's causing this person's bleeding, don't give these things yet. Let's figure out what's going on first before we put you on these things. Now, if you have a history of venous thromboembolic disease, again, like I said, you've had PEs, you've had DVTs, you've had MIs, you've had strokes, you've had cerebrovascular accidents, you should not be on any of these things. And also, they can even go into the weeds on your exams of bringing in hypercoagulable genetic diseases. So, say, for example, a person has a history of factor V Leiden, or a person has a protein C or protein S deficiency. Remember, if you have a factor V Leiden mutation, your factor V essentially has a longer half-life than is normal. Those people are very hypercoagulable. In fact, that's the most common genetic cause of hypercoagulability. In those circumstances, you should not be on this stuff. You have a protein C or protein S deficiency. Remember, protein C and protein S, they are anticoagulant proteins. If you have a history of protein C or S deficiency, you should not be on any of this stuff. Or let's say you have antithrombin 3 deficiency. Remember, you can get antithrombin 3 deficiency in many ways. You either have it as a genetic disease, or you happen to have nephrotic syndrome. Because remember, nephrotic syndrome is not only albumin that you're peeing out in your urine. One other thing you're peeing out in your urine is antithrombin 3. So nephrotic syndrome is an example of an acquired antithrombin 3 deficiency. Those people should certainly not take the stuff, because antithrombin 3 inhibits factor 10 and factor 2. So if you lose it, factor 10 and factor 2 will not be properly inhibited. That's going to raise your risk of hypercoagulability. Right? So if you have a history of coronary artery disease, history of MIs, strokes, again, don't take those things. You have a history of like breast cancer, you should not be on any of these things. If you have liver failure, because again, these things and the liver, they just think of these estrogen, progestin, and the liver, they don't mix very well. Estrogen, progestin, even progestin alone, just doesn't mix very well with the liver. So if you have histories of liver, like liver failure, like acute liver failure or chronic liver disease, or say, for example, you have a history of hepatic adenomas, you should not be on this stuff. If you have any of these genetic syndromes that are associated with hypertriglyceridemia, you shouldn't be on this stuff, because these things raise your estrogen, raises people's triglyceride levels. Another classic high yield one on exams, if you're a female and you're over 35 and you smoke, you should absolutely not be on these combined contraceptive methods. If you have a history of migraines with, migraines where, especially like these weird migraines where you see people, they have migraines and like, because you know, sometimes some people can have migraines and they have like migraines with aura, for example. Those people, they have a slightly elevated risk of stroke compared to the general population. Those people should not take any of these combined OCPs. Again, if you have nasty hypertension, you should not be on this stuff. Okay, please make sure you keep this at the back of your mind. Another weird thing our friends at the MBMs love to test are drug interactions. Because remember, if you're taking an OCP and you're taking an inducer of cytochrome P450, you're taking an OCP and you're taking an inducer of cytochrome P450, all the best to you. Because those things can induce C450. That's going to cause accelerated metabolism of the OCP. If you have accelerated metabolism of the OCP, then you'll have a shorter half-life. So you may have a period where you think that, ooh, I'm covered, but you're not covered. So what are the classic drugs here that they can throw on exams? They can give you a person being treated for active TB, rifampin. Rifampin is a CP450 inducer. Phenobarbital. Remember, you use phenobarbital for a bunch of problems, right? That can raise a person's, is a CP450 inducer. Don't forget phenytoin, so a person on an anti-epileptic drug, that can be a vignette on your test. Griseofulvin. Remember, griseofulvin, you use it for onychomycosis. So a person is gets, you know, they've used those EPs for the longest time. They were diagnosed with a dermatologic condition. They start like a fungal infection. They start taking griseofulvin, and they notice that, gee, they get pregnant. Well, griseofulvin is a cytochrome P450 inducer. Primidone. Remember, primidone is a barbiturate. So that should help you make that link with phenobarbital. It's a barbiturate. But what do you use it for? We use it for restless leg syndrome. We see a person that gets pregnant on restless leg syndrome therapy. Again, think of induction of cytochrome P450. St. John's wort. Don't forget that. People use it for mood problems, especially depressions, like a supplement you can get. St. John's wort is a CP450 inducer. Okay, so carbamazepine, right? Remember, griseofulvin, carbamazepine, phenytoin, barbiturates, rifampin, St. John's wort, primidone. Don't forget primidone. Please, don't forget primidone. Please, don't forget primidone. Again, I know these things may seem whatever, but I promise you these things are very high yield to know for exams. And again, I've told you about the benefits. These things are pretty effective. And again, they're going to reduce your risk of ovarian cancer, reduce your risk of endometrial cancer, and they reduce your risk of acne. You can even use them to treat acne. And also, premenstrual syndrome is actually very well controlled with the use of OCPs, So these are things I'll say you should kind of keep at the back of your mind with these things. Please make sure that you know this stuff I've talked about. Okay, now let's go to the progestin methods, right? So let's go to progestin only. So remember, progestin, you can get it in a pill form. You can literally get progestin in a pill form. Honestly, there is not much issue here with this. But one high yield thing to know in your exams is that if a person wants a pill after they've delivered a baby, a progestin-only pill is absolutely fine. Again, remember, the combined pill that contains estrogen and progestin is not fine. The estrogen in it is going to mess up your breast milk. So, but the progestin-only pill is absolutely okay. It's absolutely okay. Again, you see, I'm trying to give a lot of scenarios. That's the way they go after OCPs on the exams. Now, one thing I will say you want to keep at the back of your mind with this progestin-only pill is you got to take it generally at the same time every day. Okay, still commenting on these hormonal methods. Let's talk about the Mirena IUD. The Mirena IUD, obviously, is the progestin IUD. Pretty much lasts for about five years. So again, this is one, if a woman is postpartum, not a bad idea. And this is one where if you remove it, the person can return to fertility very, very quickly. You're going to see one of these progestin methods I'm going to talk about. It's actually associated with a delayed return of fertility. Now, one thing besides contraception that the Mirena IUD is used for is what? What do you think? What gynecological disorder can be treated with the Mirena IUD? I hope you're saying, oh, divine. Thinking of adenomyosis. Remember, adenomyosis is when you have endometrial glands and stroma within the myometrium. Many times those women will present with a soft, boggy, tender uterus. That can be treated with the Mirena IUD. Now, what if they give you a question about a person that has had an IUD of any sort, including the progestin IUD inserted, and then they tell you that, man, for the next 24 hours, 48 hours, 72 hours afterwards, the person is having very heavy vaginal bleeding, having significant lower abdominal pain, and then they tell you that they conduct an ultrasound, they get a transabdominal ultrasound, and they notice a foreign body, a foreign extrauterine body. What do you think happened? The uterus has been perforated. Uterine perforation is a high yield complication of IUD insertion that you want to make sure you know for your exams. Uterine perforation. It's not common, but it can certainly happen. Many times if a person has perforation of the uterus, most times you can just do conservative care, you know, maybe try to whatever, but I just don't see that as something you'll go after on your exams, because I imagine depending on the severity, so people may need a laparoscopic surgery in those circumstances. And what are some big contraindications to kind of keep at the back of your mind here? The big contraindications here is if you've had an STI within like the last 6 months, you shouldn't be on this stuff. And also if you, again, you have a history of like an breast cancer, because remember, some breast cancers are progestin receptor positive. You shouldn't take this, All right. Now, let's talk about Depo-Provera. Depo-Provera is the stuff you inject every 3 months. Again, all these progestin methods essentially work. Like I said, every progestin works. I've given that general mechanism of action earlier on in the podcast. Now, this one is riddled with a number of problems. Number one, weight gain. This stuff can cause you to gain weight. And there's also this thing with decreasing your bone mineral density, although it's reversible. So these Depo-Provera is actually associated with a reversible decrease in bone mineral density. So you may want to be on calcium, vitamin D supplementation when you're taking these drugs. Now, one high yield thing to know about this is is associated with a delayed return of fertility. So if a person is like, oh, I want to be able to stop this contraceptive method and get pregnant quick, this is not what you should be giving to those people. Some people, it takes them up to 2 years, up to what? 2 years after stopping Depo-Provera before they get pregnant again. Okay, what's the other kind of progestin business? Well, don't forget your implantables. The big one is Nexplanon. It's a progestin implantable. You pretty much put it in your inner arm, lasts for about three years. And again, what are the unique things here? Again, you can put this postpartum. It's very good. And again, remember, progestin only stuff can be used postpartum, not a problem. Now, this one does not change your bone mineral density. Again, remember, all those unique things are with Depo-Provera, the injectable every 3 month business. But Nexplanon, the implantable stuff, it doesn't change your bone mineral density. And once you remove it, you can return to fertility very, very quickly. Okay, you can return to fertility very, very quickly, Okay, so again, remember, Depo-Provera is the one that has those unique problems, And don't forget that Nexplanon is considered on the USMLEs as a LARC. Okay, Nexplanon is considered on the USMLEs as what? As a LARC. I'm going to say that again. Nexplanon is considered on the USMLEs as what? As a LARC. Please make sure you know these things. Like, literally, I'm begging you. Make sure you know these things. So again, please, those contraindications I gave for estrogen, progestin, whatever OCPs, they pretty much apply to these progestin-only methods, right? Progestin-only methods, again, like the breast cancer business, the liver issues, right? So say, for example, a person has cirrhosis, acute hepatitis or whatever, they shouldn't be on anything that really contains hormones, like estrogen or progestin. Is not a good idea. Not a good idea in these folks. So please, again, kind of keep that at the back of your mind. Okay, so the IUD, we've talked about the Mirena IUD. Let's talk about the copper IUD. Again, this one does not contain hormones. Basically, what it does is that it pretty much mounts a very powerful foreign body reaction against sperm. It essentially damages the sperm, destroys the sperm. Now, again, remember, kind of like the same thing we see with the progestin IUDs. If you stop these things, if you remove it, boom, you're going to be able to get pregnant fairly quickly. And again, it doesn't have hormones. So obviously, if a person has a contraindication to many of these hormones that I talked about, all these contraindications, breast cancer, you can be on the copper IUD. You can literally be on the copper IUD. Now, what are the contraindications to the copper IUD? The big one is, again, if you have a history of Wilson's disease, you already have a copper excess. Why should you be getting some extra copper? That doesn't make much of any sense. Now, let me say something actually. Maybe because I talked about some progestin IUD contraindications, talked about some copper IUD contraindications, the big one being Wilson's disease. But let me just talk about some contraindications for both. So if, for example, you have an ongoing STI, you should not take an IUD, right? That seems like a nice way to establish a very beautiful nidus for infection. So if a person has an STI right now, has been having an STI for the last few months, especially like that 6 month time frame, you really shouldn't be on any kind of IUD. Or if a person has like a risky lifestyle, let's say this person has had multiple STIs, you know, they're like a they should probably not be on an IUD. Okay? That's kind of important to know for exams. Another thing I will say that may be an answer you may see on your exam as well is if you have like distorted uterine anatomy. So let's say you have like a weirdly shaped uterus or whatever. It is probably not a good idea to be on these two kinds of on any kind of IUD. And the thing I'm going to say with the copper IUD is, if you're a person that bleeds heavily, or you have a condition that makes people bleed, like von Willebrand disease or hemophilia or whatever, you should probably not be on a copper IUD, because copper IUDs are associated with heavy bleeding. Okay, they're associated with heavy bleeding. Please make sure you know these things for your exams. All right. So I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here. Again, I think I've kind of hit on a lot of the major stuff with with contraception. Again, if you're interested in any of my review courses, I made a podcast where I talk about those. I have a bunch of courses for step one all the way to step three, basically running from next week Thursday. I believe that's the 18th of April. I'm pretty sure that's the 18th of April. So I have a test taking class, 2.5 hours long for step 1 to 3. I have a biostats class, 4 hours long. It's on Friday. It's a 4 hour class for step 1 to 3. I have a social sciences and ethics class, very good class, on Saturday. It's a 5 hour class for step 1 to 3. And then the Monday after that, from the 22nd to the 26th, I have a step 2 class. It's a 20 hour class. And then I have a 3 hour last minute review on the 27th of this month. And then from May 1st to May 5th, I have a 25 hour step 1 class. Again, these classes, there's many people that have attended them, had very huge score improvements, done extremely well on the exams. If you're interested, just shoot me an email. I can give you some more information. And then I also have the grand class, the 50 hour step 2, step 3 class. It's a 500 multiple choice question class taking place in the month of June. Just check that out. I think you'll find it to be extremely helpful. Extremely helpful. All right. So I also offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLEs and med school exams and shelf exams. I have this podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify. I have a YouTube channel. I can check out, that's where I post the videos that I make. And I also help with applications. So I meet with people one-on-one to help out with applications, recommendation letters, personal statements, and things of that nature. And then I also have another website called DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. Basically, every week, typically on Fridays and Sundays, I post a 10-minute-ish podcast where, using the Bible, I discuss a life lesson. Many people have listened to those podcasts and found them to be remarkably helpful. And I just address biblical topics. So some people use it as a devotional and things like that. I think we have today I made episode 263. So it's a pretty helpful website. There's actually an Apple podcast associated with that, the Divine Intervention Life Lessons podcast. So thank you for listening to me today. I will see you in episode 532, I think. So God bless you. Have a wonderful weekend, and bye for now. Thank you.